Hey folks, happy 2017. I want to remind you we still have Partially Examined Life calendars left at partiallyexaminedlife.com/store. That is, of course, only one of many ways you can support this endeavor, and I absolutely want to thank any of you that have ever made a donation, become a Partially Examined Life citizen for whatever length of time. If you feel like you can't afford that, you can actually still help out. Now, I bet you use Amazon. If you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com and click the Amazon banner ad, then anything you add to your cart during that session, not just books but anything, will at no additional cost to you send somewhere around 6% of your purchase price our way. And if you make a habit of that, over time that's really going to help us out. For more information on this and other ways to support us, please see partiallyexaminedlife.com/support. Thanks! You are listening to The Partially Examined Life, a podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 155 is something like, what assumptions underlie the search for a theory of knowledge? We read Richard Rorty's Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature, Part 2, Mirroring, specifically Chapters 3 and 4, published in 1979. To get the reading and more information, please check out partiallyexaminedlife.com. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, appealing only to the judgment of my peers in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Allwun, epistemically privileged in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, just a perceptual metaphor in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Why, this episode is a sequel, more or less, to the last two, the first of which, 153, we started talking about this book, about chapter one mostly, and then we took a detour into talking about Wilfred Sellers' argument against the myth of the given, which plays a central part in the critique here, as does Quine. And we did a Quine episode, but the stuff about Quine is actually about essays that we didn't read. So I had to do a little outside reading.
He brings up two dogmas of empiricism.
Yes.
But you're right, it's not the focus of it.
What do you mean? There's a whole
section on Quine, but Mark's saying that we didn't read the stuff that Rorty focuses on.
Oh, I see.
The stuff that we did read, a major point about that, just to refresh, had to do with the notion of linguistic meaning, as in this word is synonymous with this other word. This word means something else, he thought was kind of bogus. And the way it's discussed in this reading is in terms of indeterminacy of translation. So let's say you meet somebody that you don't know their language, and they try to teach it to you. So you're ET learning the human language, and they point to something and say, rabbit, you know, but using a word that you don't know, then you don't actually know whether they're referring to that animal or to a stage of that animal at this slice of time. You don't know how they're carving up the world. And the only way you could find that out is by asking them more questions. So you kind of have to come up with a theory of, well, okay, I think they're referring to this animal, something, you know, that they have approximately the same conceptual scheme that I do. And then you can figure out more. But there's always going to be something indeterminate about that. There are always going to be multiple possible ways to translate that. If you kind of apply that across the board, one thing to talk about is any set of data in science, there's always going to be more than one theory, more than one conceptual scheme, more than one net that you could use to explain or to even describe that set of data. The alternative to just figuring out based on context, based on asking more questions, based on coming up with a theory that could always be challenged is by somehow fixing at least some point right to reality. But we saw in that example of ostension, just pointing at the thing and saying rabbit, you can't even do that. So yeah. How does that relate to what we were talking about with Rorty on mind and Sellers on mind last time? If we're saying figuring out somebody's meaning is not a matter of figuring out what extra linguistic thing in their head their word corresponds to. If that's not what meanings are about, meanings are about mapping words onto other words in socially acceptable ways.
It's a social construct. It's the interactions that we have with each other that define those rules of the game and those what those objects are.
So was there any other sort of background knowledge that we needed to refresh ourselves on?
Before we talk about the very end of the reading and the previous episode.
Yeah, Mark leapt to the very end of the reading.
Well, I like talking about what the point of this all is.
So the Quine thing actually seemed to me to be the least relevant and most confusing for me. So chapter three, the overarching point of this is he's going to challenge philosophy as it's typically conceived as a sort of epistemological enterprise that grounds other sciences, other ways of knowing, and is foundational to them or can sort of suss out their foundations and give them some sort of credibility. He gives a nice history of how philosophy sort of takes on that character, beginning with the attempts of early modern philosophers to make a place for sciences in a religious world. At that point, philosophy was sort of continuous with the sciences, and then the development of that through Descartes and Locke and Kant into this version of philosophy, which is no longer continuous with science, but has this special epistemological role. So that's how we kick it off here. And that's the overall point of all of this, is to create this challenge. But he's going to give a long description in chapter 3 of what all that means, this error, how it's mistaken as well.
And then the follow-up chapter is to sort of really go in deep on a couple of particular formulations of that criticism in Sellars and Quine, not completely agreeing with them, in the end criticizing them both a bit, but putting himself squarely in a space with those two and Wittgenstein, or at least Philosophical Investigations Wittgenstein, as being anti-foundationalist and having a deep criticism of that historical project of philosophy, which he, I think, wants to say that that just happened to be the historical evolution of philosophy as having defined itself in that way. And there are historical reasons why philosophy has come to understand itself in that way, but that's not the only way philosophy has to be.
So yeah, so chapter 4, he's, in a way, Sellars and Quine represent a particular way out of the problem, which is that, you know, we'll see in chapter 4 that he thinks Kantianism pervades both continental and analytic philosophy. Its assumptions pervade it. And I think there are certain philosophers which he notes sort of get us out of that, like Wittgenstein and Dewey and Heidegger. Yet he's going to focus in chapter 4 on Sellars and Quine in particular, because they sort of, even though I don't think he thinks they completely give up the Kantian framework, they're sort of the beginning of the end in the sense that they get at some fundamental flaws in the whole picture, which we sort of discussed in our Sellars episode, One Horn of That.
So he's going to say both those guys somehow did not go far enough, which it makes it sound like, the way he puts it, that they should have been more like relativists. That Sellars, you know, we were saying that talk about mental representations is a little suspect in that you can't use them as you might think to ground knowledge, right? Your immediate acquaintance with what the color red is like or what a pain is like is not sufficient to actually ground anything. So it sounds very behaviorist to say that, no, instead we have to sort of learn the language game of red or of pain. And there might be an inner feel, there might be still a qualia, but that doesn't actually play any explanatory role in me deciding whether you're in pain or not. But it always seems like it's ready to slide into some kind of, if not actual behaviorism, to say that, well, the language that we use to talk about the mental, for instance, is an immature, is a folk psychology, right? This is how Churchland, Pat and her husband Paul, who were students of Quine, how they argue for eliminative materialism. In other words, talk about beliefs and all that stuff should eventually, or at least in a real scientific language, be replaced by talk of brain states. And so this whole trip, Rorty thinks, is, so it's the idea of, okay, well, we found out that some kinds of talk about beliefs, are just a matter of historically contingent circumstances. It's an optional, it's not something at the dawn of time that occurred to everyone as the central problem of philosophy. It's just something that built up because of the particular metaphors that philosophers used. But still, once we get rid of that, there's some more respectable scientific way of describing things. And Rorty really wants to kind of go farther and say that, no, all the allegedly scientific, all the physicalistic and all, you know, those are all still historically developed ways of talking about these things. And so it's not Sellars ends up, and we didn't see this because we didn't, you know, Sellars and Quine, they have all these positive works about philosophy that we have not read, philosophy as continuous with science. But Rorty wants to save the humanities. He wants to say that there are scientific language games and there are literary language games. And, you know, he does tend to think that epistemology in particular, once we get rid of these assumptions, that these metaphors that drive it, that there's kind of nothing left for it to do. Like the things it was trying to do either can be done by different branches of science, or they can just as well be done through literature and other talk in the humanities that philosophies claim to be the queen of the sciences, underlying them all and judging them is ill-founded.
Yeah, that particular part is he's happy to dispense with. I might put it a little bit different way, that I think that Rorty sees the activity of philosophy as something that really amounts to thinking things through, and that that's not unique to some kind of profession of philosophy that endeavors to provide the foundations for all of our thinking, both scientific and moral, which is where he sees philosophy having staked out a claim for its own existence.
Well, I like the connection to morality was an eye-opener here. And he says he got this right from Sellers, but I kind of must have missed this or missed the emphasis on this. We kind of think that a mature take on ethics acknowledges in some ways that it's a matter of ongoing historical discussion, that right and wrong are to some degree, in some way, human inventions. And so many of our episodes have been to try to give an account for that, that doesn't just collapse into pure relativism, you know, that still gives room for more wise ways of arguing moral points and more foolish ways that if you thought about them a little more, then you would say, no, that's not a sustainable morality. But that ultimately a lot of the arguments that we make, the only ones that are going to be effective, end up being arguments about coherence. In other words, you shouldn't do that because you have some prior belief that that kind of thing is wrong. Well, so that's just the first part of the analogy. Rorty wants to extend that to epistemology as well. Like all beliefs are not just, which seems crazy, like beliefs about math and about the state of the natural world don't seem to be human inventions in the way that morality probably is.
I think he's wrong and I think he's a relativist, but it's going to be hard for me to explain that.
Well, I think he's right and he's a relativist, so.
So there you go. We've staked out our positions in the first bit. I'll just say I find it intriguing. I find it an intriguing connection. The way I was just describing it makes it sound like, yeah, there are obvious differences between sets of beliefs about what other people should do and ideals that I hold up for myself. Those are one kind of thing. And then claims about the state of the physical world are not obviously social facts, even if the particular language that we use to describe things, of course, developed as a matter of contingent historical circumstance.
Even though he uses that pejorative of merely social facts, which is sort of the way of saying, well, it's just so wishy-washy, right? It's not that the claim that our understanding of geometry is merely a social fact, like the way in which we agree on stoplights or that we drive on the right side of the road, but that, what's the phrase he uses? That it's knowledge that versus knowledge of, and that our understanding of mathematics is a development of a language to account for our interaction with the world that works. And when we say that it works, the justification for that does not lie in some third thing.
The claim is that it doesn't rely in a relationship to a mind-independent world. It lies in a relationship to other sentences produced by other language users. That's the claim.
Which is where it gets really weird to me.
Well, it's man is the measure of all things. It's relativism, and it's a confusion of justification and truth. The way we justify things, yes, we can't go out and say, oh, look, here's the mind-independent reality. Does it match my sentence? Of course, that's not the way we justify things. We do justify things in the coherence frame by relating our assertions to assertions of others and do assertions that are meant to serve as forms of justification. But you can't have a coherent notion of, you'll notice he doesn't talk really about truth, or he implies that the theory of truth and the theory of justification are the same thing, because that's a sort of pragmatic assumption. But I don't think that makes any sense. The theory of justification, theory of truth are not the same thing. What people are searching for when they're in the case of truth is they're trying to explain what in the world or what somewhere else could serve to explain why a sentence is true. The sentence can't be true because I justified it. Sentence isn't true because I went through, and a geometrical proof isn't true because I demonstrated it. The demonstration shows that it's true, justifies its truth, but it's not true because I demonstrated it, or because it's, in general, demonstrable.
I'm thinking back of our pragmatism episode where actually Rorty's name did come up as someone that, I don't know where, one of us found that Rorty was given as example of somebody that denied William James' claim that truth was to be defined in terms of human practices. You could say, sure, the definition of truth is not that, but still, for practical purposes, when you are seeking to justify something, when you are seeking to prove that something is true, it is a matter of making argument. It's a matter of what the sophist does. This is the way Rorty puts it in this, which is like trying to come up with an airtight case that no one will just test it on people and you see if somebody thinks of something to say against it, rather than trying to connect it to a mind-independent entity. So it's not giving a definition of truth. It's talking about the procedures by which we deal with truth, the role that truth plays in life.
Yeah, and there's nothing else you can do, right? There's no other way that it works.
I mean, you could claim as part of your reasons, right, that isn't it obvious? Isn't it written in the structure or the fabric of the world
isn't it clear and distinct?
X equals X or something? Isn't it exactly?
No, that's not. This is a conflation of the process of justification, the question of how we know things, and the question of what it means for something to be true. So there is no coherent, as far as I'm concerned, conception of an idea of a sentence being true without an appeal to a mind-independent reality, as problematic as that appeal is. Now, that, of course, doesn't mean that the way we justify things is to say, hey, look at the mind-independent reality and see how it matches the sentence. That doesn't work.
But that's not what's being said. Rorty and the pragmatists would certainly allow for a mind-independent reality, that it exists outside.
That's not what I've gathered from reading any of Rorty.
Well,
I think I agree with Dylan that he does allow for it, just like that he does allow for private experiences and qualia. He just thinks that they play no role in justification.
Yeah.
And that is what has been at issue in trying to come up with a theory of knowledge, what philosophers are doing.
Well, that modest claim, that Sellersian claim, let's call it, I think is right on. That's not what I think is his claim in the second part of this. But if that's the claim, then I think that's right on. That's not what I got out of this. And I think when we get into the details, I can explain it further.
Shall we start with chapter 3?
Yes.
Sure.
So the idea of a theory of knowledge is the title of chapter 3. Theory of knowledge in quotes. So it's not what can we know? It's does the question what can we know make sense? Does the whole enterprise of epistemology make sense?
So he's going to say how this whole enterprise, he's going to give a historical account of why it even arises.
The end of the first section, where he talks about the three things that Kant did, which helped philosophy as epistemology become, he calls it self-conscious and self-confident. I thought it was a real great summary of his point of view on it. Kant did three things which helped philosophy as epistemology become self-conscious and self-confident. First, by identifying the central issue of epistemology as the relations between two equally real but irreducibly distinct sorts of representations, formal ones, concepts, and material ones, intuitions. He made it possible to see important continuities between the new epistemological problematic and problems, the problems of reason and of universals, which had bothered the ancients and the medievals. He thereby made it possible to write histories of philosophy of the modern sort. Second, by linking epistemology to morality in the project of destroying reason to make room for faith, that is, destroying Newtonian determinism to make room for the common moral consciousness, he revived the notion of a complete philosophical system, one in which morality was grounded on something less controversial and more scientific. Whereas the ancient schools had each had a view of human virtue designed to match their view of what the world was like, Newton had preempted views on the latter subject. With Kant, epistemology was able to step into metaphysics' role as guarantor of the presuppositions of morality. Third, by taking everything we say to be about something we have constituted, he made it possible for epistemology to be thought of as a foundational science, an armchair discipline capable of discovering the formal characteristics of any area of human life. He thus enabled philosophy professors to see themselves as presiding over a tribunal of pure reason, able to determine whether other disciplines were staying within the legal limits set by their structure of their subject matters.
All right, so that's what a full page.
Yeah, that was a long quote. Like.
So maybe we break it down?
Well, I think we'll break it down as we move on in the chapter, because Kant himself, for Rorty, represents a sort of advance on a more primitive notion, let's say. The big distinction in this chapter is between, as you guys have mentioned, knowledge that and knowledge of. And for Rorty, it's the use of what he calls the ocular metaphor, which I think we discussed in the first part of this, that leads us astray. It's this modeling of knowledge on a interaction between a subject and an object instead of a relationship between a person and what he calls a proposition. So I think we should say a little bit more what he means by that.
I mean, we got that pretty clearly in the Sellers last time.
Okay.
However, we just taught it like, obviously, these are different things. And traditional philosophy has somehow confused them in trying to do this foundationalist enterprise. What we did not discuss, I mean, you're really pointing, Wes, at the unspoken issue with this, that even if you acknowledge that what knowledge is really about is my relationship to a proposition, and that if I'm going to argue for that proposition, I have to use other propositions. But still, it seems like, well, what actually makes a proposition true is the relation of that proposition to the world, the problem of reference. So even if it's not my knowledge of the world, it's still then my knowledge that a proposition corresponds to the world. So just making the distinction between knowledge of and knowledge that would not get rid of the entire connection with the world. He has to then go on and have the only way to talk about the truth of a proposition is in terms of its relationship to other propositions, other sentences, which does seem to then leave the whole thing unrooted, which is exactly what he wants to do.
Right. Yeah, so we saw with our Tractatus episode that you can use the metaphor even to talk about propositions and facts, right? As early Wittgenstein did, you could just make facts these sort of fundamental ontological entities out there in the world and not objects, but they sort of seem very object-like, right? And then your propositions have to correspond to those facts. And I still think that kind of model is the sort of thing to which Rorty is objecting, where having knowledge is a matter of this kind of relationship to the world. So where that leads us astray is that once you believe that, then when you think that justifying beliefs, as in the project of epistemology, means appealing to, say, the proper functioning of the mind, something like that, instead of the typical common sense justification of appealing to relations to other propositions. So it's the task of someone like Locke to say, well, how does the mind function in such a way that it can represent reality accurately? This whole problem of representation crops up once you think of knowledge as a relationship between subject and object, because you get this intermediate layer. And once you think of the object as sort of impressing itself on the subject, like something, you know, impressing itself on wax, then the imprint on the subject becomes the representation. And then you have to worry about how the representation lines up with this external imprinting thing. He refers back to Sellers and saying Locke was trying to analyze epistemic facts without remainder into non-epistemic facts. It's this idea that you can look at knowledge from within, from inside, or from outside. And the sort of epistemological idea, beginning here with Locke and then moving on to Descartes and others, is that you can sort of get outside of knowledge and not think about it simply in terms of these justificatory relations to other propositions, but in terms of some kind of model of objects, right? You think, oh, here's the person and here's the object, and there's a line between the two of them, as if they're all these external things, and I can describe knowledge by treating them almost as elements in a physical system. And that is the kind of error that's involved here, he thinks.
Yes, because in the end, that putting the line in between those objects involves judgments, which are essentially propositions about the character of what you're seeing, as you to go back to the ocular metaphor.
So you might think that there at least are some kind of basic perceptual situations. We talked about this with Sellers last time, where I'm put in front of a red object in normal lighting conditions and my eyes are working, and therefore I am imprinted with red. There's nothing I can do. It's just the physiological mechanisms that make me have this idea red. And that somehow is a foundation.
But even Sellers, right, will make all kinds of qualifications for that, but it still will be a proposition. It will be one that has a lot of good explanation for it, and there's all kinds of good reasons for it, which amount to it being corroborated effectively by other people agreeing with it. But it's not foundational in the sense that everybody will have that clear and distinct image. He constrains it enough so that there will be enough common ground about it. It will be less easy to object to it, but it still will have that same kind of propositional character.
So remember, clear and distinct idea is almost analogous to a Platonic form or a,
exactly, yes,
some sort of necessary truth. But I think once you've reached the analytic philosophy and sense data theorist, he thinks that's reverted back to Locke. The certainty lies in these presentations to the empirical faculty, let's say. And so if you think about how does a sense data theorist justify a proposition, well, you analyze it. And by analyzing it, you break it down and you see, oh, look, this larger claim about the, you know, the cat is on the mat actually breaks down into a bunch of different atomic claims, which are just ascriptions of sense data, let's say to spatiotemporal points or something like that. And that because we know those individual sense data and then we properly assemble them, we properly infer the larger fact from the more atomic ones, then our knowledge is justified because of that. Well, that's the kind of justification which I think Rorty thinks confuses the kind of causal, and as we saw Sellars did too, the causal account of how we get to know things and how we actually justify things. So justifying the cat on the mat doesn't really depend on our analysis into sense data. And as Sellars points out, sense data as sense data aren't even knowable in a sense anyway. They ground knowing. They have to happen before you know things, but they can't be appealed to as justifications.
Yeah, they're not the contents of our phenomenological consciousness at any point. We always get them already baked into objects according to the theory. But then why even believe the theory if there's no way of independently verifying that there is this given before it's processed?
Before we go on, let's stop and talk about our sponsor this time, Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers fresh ingredients to your home along with recipes that are much, much cooler than anything that I would make on my own. For instance, some of the meals available in January are seared pork chops with farro and cranberry chutney, spaghetti squash and marinara with mushrooms and garlic knots, spicy shrimp and Korean rice cakes with cabbage and furikake. Now, I don't know what all those individual things are, but kind of like when you go to a nice restaurant, pretty much everything is good. I am a Blue Apron customer. I was before they became our sponsor. I figured out recently that in addition to the documentation that they send you for the recipes, you can also go on their website and they'll show you techniques of how to do the cutting and grinding and drizzling and whatever it is that that recipe needs. So it's all very educational if, like me, you're interested in cooking but pretty bad at it. Now, they've asked me to emphasize their beef is raised humanely, their chickens are free range, their pork is raised naturally, the produce uses regenerative farming practices, seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they're reducing food waste. So you will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Check out this week's menu. Get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/PEL. That's blueapron.com/PEL. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
You had mentioned Wittgenstein before and early Wittgenstein and was making me think of the relativist strain even in the Tractatus, where he thought that there were these atomic facts, which we had a lot of trouble figuring out, like, well, what is an example of an atomic fact? They seem to be so atomic, like these sense data we were just talking about, that we never actually interact with them. Any actual sentence we would make is a wider net, is a conceptual scheme that is built out of many, 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 many atomic facts. So our whole way of knowing things is ultimately holistic, even though supposedly through analysis, at least in theory, you could break down any given actual belief into reference to atomic facts. So the only movement then from early to later Wittgenstein is just giving up the deep-seated part, giving up this atomic fact idea and just accepting the fact that you've got, again, the indeterminacy of translation or whatever metaphor that I was pulling from Quine is, you know, that there's more than one way to describe any given thing.
Yeah, I thought what you just described, Mark, as the question raised by the Tractatus was a perfect example of why you would write philosophical investigations.
All right, so we have this sort of Lockean framework in which it's knowledge of, which is primitive instead of knowledge that, and Kant sort of gets us halfway there. Kant recognizes that whether you're appealing to sort of the rationalist framework of clear and distinct ideas or you're appealing to the empirical framework of Lockean presentations to get you off the ground, you need something more complex, which is really what it amounts to is the proposition, which for Kant is this synthesis of concept and intuition, or universal in particular. So that's the sense in which Kant is sort of trending in the right direction, but it's going to turn out he doesn't get all the way there.
Which was the first part of that long quote that Dylan read, that he thought in terms of the relationship between two kinds of representations, intuitions and concepts. And so that still amounts to, it's not us relating to propositions, that's us relating to these mental contents, some of which are intuitions and some of which are concepts.
It's us relating to objects, but objects in Kant's world are the appearances, and they are the union of concept and intuition. Unconsciously, behind the scenes, our mind engages in this constructive activity. So this is, I think, the main thing that Rorty is going to object to, this idea that the relation is to our own constructions. The idea is that we do this constructing thing, putting concepts together with intuitions behind the scenes, and then producing these appearances, these objects in our world. And then we come back to it with judgment, and we sort of recapitulate that process at a conscious level, but in a more analytic capacity. So we come back to our construction and we say, oh, look, this is how it's constructed. And we make a proposition, and which relates a particular to a universal, which essentially, you know, acknowledges something that we already did ourselves behind the scenes. And Kant thinks there's something to that which makes knowledge possible. He's still working on this old problem of the relationship between mind and its unbridgeable gap to this unknowable reality. Well, Kant thinks that you solve that problem by making it a gap not between the mind and an unknowable reality, but between the mind and the thing that's been made by the mind.
And can we just refresh, since we haven't talked about Kant in a while, and I'm sure a lot of people are, well, intuitions and concepts, what exactly does that mean? Like, can we give an example of, is an intuition like a sense data, or like my sense of space, that space and time exist, that geometry, that, so it involves both the sensory given that we were talking about in terms of the empiricists, but also the rationally given, you might say, X equals X, and the notions of identity, that there's always a specific number of things. Those are all intuitions, and then concepts. How does concept interact with that, or do I not have intuition right?
So intuitions are something like particulars, but they themselves get constructed by the faculty of intuition in space and time. So what we get, I think in Kant, what we get is what he calls a manifold, which it's unclear exactly what that is, which kind of speaks to this whole problem. The manifold is pre-knowledge, so there's no way to talk about it. Once we've spatio-temporalized that, once we've sort of added one part of what it needs to be a particular, and then the concepts of the understanding, like unity and substance and things like that, go the extra leg in that regard.
Isn't the manifold the connection to the world, so to speak? Without that other stuff, it doesn't get broken up into individual entities. It isn't experienced in any way that you could say anything about, but it's the conduit for the world becoming phenomenal for us.
Yeah. So think of the manifold as sort of the result of stimuli from the problem is it sort of violates Kant's own way of talking about things. But the only way to think about it is that there's these things in themselves and they somehow interact with us and they cause these stimuli, but they're not stimuli in the way we typically think.
So those stimuli are the intuitions, though.
Stimuli, I think, as sense data. They're not the sense. No, the intuitions have already been worked over. So there's a working over of the manifold into an intuition, and then there's the larger relationship of concepts to the intuitions themselves. So we already have spatio-temporal particulars. Just think of them as particulars in the world. And then we want to make generalizations about them. We want to make predications. We want to say, you know, hey, that cat is white, where we relate that particular, the cat, to the concept of being white. That's what happens at the level of the understanding and the concept. But before all that happens, everything has to be constructed conceptually. There's really two sorts of construction. One is the intuitional construction in space and time, and then the other is the addition of all the higher level categories of the understanding where we make it a knowable object.
Just to clarify how sense data corresponds to these things, it seems like the notion of sense data has been broken up into two stages. That you might have thought sense data were just the irritation of my eye or something. But the way you're saying, no, that kind of gets us the manifold, but then there's a first line of processing that makes it into something that's in space and time, and that gets us the intuition. And then actually saying that it is the color red or a dog is concept. So concepts are kind of mean what we normally think they mean. It's just intuition and the manifold are the more technical terms here.
Yeah. By the time we get sense data, and this is really part of Seller's point and why he was such a defender of Kant, it's already worked over by the faculties of intuition and the understanding. It's already been conceptualized. So the sense data aren't the manifold. Or you could think of the sense data as the manifold, but in that sense, they're not knowable. Once we said, hey, this is a red part in space and time, we're already at the conceptual level. And to say that we know that is already to be within the framework of propositions and justification and all that stuff. It's not a raw knowledge relationship to this datum, to the given.
One big thing we're saying, why doesn't Kant go far enough? Just to recharacterize the problem that he thought Locke had was that, again, he was confusing justification with causation. And the way we were putting it before is the idea that you could reduce all talk of knowledge to talk about causality, at least at some basic level. So how do I have the knowledge that there is a red spot in front of me, which is a very innocent kind of knowledge? At least it seems red. That's the paradigmatic case of the given that we were already saying that Sellers is arguing against.
Or maybe it's more helpful to say, how do I know the cat is on the mat? And then give a reduction to sense data or give a Lockean account of, well, the mind is related to the world in this way. There's an external object, the cat, it impresses itself on the mind and blah, blah, blah. You know,
like, exactly. Yeah. So Kant still has, according to Rorty, a problem in that it's a matter of causation of the world, even though, you know, technically causality is something that only happens within the space of appearances, and we don't know, either we don't know or it just cannot apply to the thing in itself. Still, the way he talks about constitution, he uses the word constitution instead. The only way that we can actually understand that is like the way that you were just describing it, Wes, is somehow the combination of the world and the mind makes us therefore have this knowledge. So even though his account of how that happens is different than Locke's, still the overall form of the account that it's non-epistemic things, it's the relationship between a subject and object that somehow creates knowledge, that is the problem.
Yeah, Rorty is saying Kant confuses predication with synthesis, which is the higher level version of the Lockean error. So that instead of saying, oh, why is the cat white? Well, there's this object and it impresses itself on my mind and blah, blah, blah. In Kantian terms, you say you get this manifold and then you work it over with certain concepts and intuitions until it looks like a white cat. And then you come back to it and make the judgment, hey, this is a white cat. So it's still a causal account in terms of it's a how the mind works account. When really the way we would justify that knowledge claim in our day-to-day lives is different. I'm not sure what you do with the white cat, other than point to it and say, look, can't you see it's white? But ultimately for Rorty, it's a matter of appealing to other propositions. That's the actual way we justify things.
Well, and interacting with other people. So it's not even just me considering different propositions. It's that, you know, it seems obvious there's a white cat on the mat. But then if different people come to me and say, no, 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 that's not even there, then that will be a pretty good justification for me to question what seemed an extremely obvious claim. And that's the only kind of challenge that really comes up in practice.
I've internalized this social practice and language use and all these things that, well, I'm not sure how you would think about that actually.
Yeah, is it just a language game that we all agree that the cat is on the mat and that we all carve up the world such that, again, it's a cat and not a cat state? It's not a cat right now, just like the rabbit thing before. That is it just custom?
The reason why I got tripped up there is if I try to justify the cat is white in terms of an appeal to language games and social practice and things like that, I think I'm making the same error again that he's criticizing, because I'm just giving another causal account. I have to appeal to propositions which actually support it internally. So
yeah, you explain it rather than justify it.
Let me just make the error here. It seems like when we give a reason Why do I believe the cat is on the mat? Well, because I walked in the room and I looked there and I'm in normal lighting conditions and I'm not drunk. And so I refer to that, this causal account, as a pretty good prima facie reason for believing that the cat is in fact on the mat. So what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that.
I think he does say there's something wrong with that.
What do you mean by saying that was the wrong way of doing it, Mark? You mean to provide an example of talking about it that Rorty would disagree with?
If he says that Locke makes the mistake and then Kant makes the mistake of confusing causation with justification, well, maybe I'm not confusing those two, but actually as my justification, giving a causal account.
Yeah, Rorty explicitly discusses this and rejects it. You're confused if you talk about justification in terms of an appeal to the correct functioning of the faculty.
The correct functioning of the faculty.
Yeah, you say, my eyes aren't messed up, my mind is working properly, my brain is working properly, things like that. That's the causal account that he's rejecting. To justify in the sense that he likes is to give reasons why you think the cat is white.
But I took that all to be part of the process of giving reasons. I don't see why those are excluded. I mean, when you say the cat is white, there's a white cat on the mat. I don't see how Rorty's argument rejects all of the qualifications that you'd have to be if you were being pushed to the wall about it. Ultimately, you would end up saying, well, because I saw this with my eyes and that was the only way I am sure of it, there's all kinds of reasons that I could have seen a cat on the mat that there wasn't actually a cat on the mat. And I can't be any more certain about it than that, than I looked and I saw a cat on a mat and it was white.
The causal account is defeasible is what you're saying.
Yeah. I think you guys are using causal account in a very precise way.
No, he explicitly discusses this.
I might not be understanding how you guys, and maybe even how Rorty is using this term, causal account. Invoking causality in the sense of A leads to B, I don't see how that is in any way not part of Rorty's way of explaining the world. That you would say A leads to B.
You don't justify a proposition. You don't say, I know X because of some account that describes a causal relationship between me, the subject, and then the world.
I'm very confused about the ground that is being stood on here. The claim that I give these justifications for the space in which I know this white cat is on the mat, is explanatory. I guess I'm not seeing how that relies on some deep account of the impressions that it's making on me.
Can we make the distinction that Sellers makes between facts and rules? So the fact that I am in a causal relationship with a thing is a fact, but the fact that I am saying the cat is on the mat by referring to my causal relationship is obeying the rule of how we typically justify that sort of phenomenon, right? So as opposed to a thermometer also says it's 96 degrees because it is reacting to the fact, to a causal fact, but it is not obeying a rule. It is not conscious of a rule. It's not looking at a rule.
Yes.
And the fact that we are looking at a rule and not merely being caused means that we're giving an explanation. Even though we used causation in the explanation, it's the fact that we're explicitly referring to it. Does that fix it? Or
that sounds right. I mean, I guess I would say it is, we use causality to explain things all the time. That's the bedrock form of how we make any kind of explanation at all. And this is why I think that you're using causal explanation in a different way than what I mean.
Can we clarify that it's explaining why I know something?
No, it's a causal relationship between subject and object, or between parts of the mind. It's a particular kind of causal relationship that's at issue. It's not, I can't say, well, why is X the case? Well, something caused something. That's fine. But I don't say I know something.
I completely agree.
I think it's clear with higher level propositions rather than something that seems to depend on ostension, which is where we're getting tripped up, because it's unclear how you cope with that in Rorty's picture. But, you know, for a higher level, more complex propositions, obviously we're making appeals to other propositions. Why do you believe that Trump is a great president? Well, he's going to make America great again, and he's going to do this, and he's going to do that. Those sorts of explanations.
It's just I was in the presence of Trump, and he caused me to acknowledge his greatness. I didn't even want to.
Yes. The epistemological explanation is that, well, the mind is attuned to things that are great, and great things can cause a clear and distinct great impression, and that happened to me. And
in fact, my faculty of greatness detection went into gear. I didn't even know I had such a thing.
So on page 141, he talks about this appeal to the proper functioning. So Green's distinction between an element of knowledge and conditions of the organism reminds us that a claim to knowledge is a claim to have justified belief, and that it is rarely the case that we appeal to the proper functioning of the organism as a justification. Granted that we sometimes justify belief, and I think this is going to clarify some of this, by saying, for example, I have good eyes, why should we think that chronological or compositional relations between ideas conceived of as events in inner space could tell us about the logical relations between propositions? After all, as Seller says, in characterizing an episode or a state as that of knowing, we are not giving an empirical description of that episode or state. We are placing it in the logical space of reasons, or being able to justify what one says. So again, when we say someone is confusing causality and justification, and we object to a causal explanation, we're talking about a particular kind of causal explanation about the relationship between the subject and the object, as opposed to justifications, which again are in a way internal to our logical space. When you give the epistemological explanation, you're stepping outside of the logical space. Instead of saying Trump is great because of propositions X, Y, and Z, you say it by trying to step outside of the whole picture and say, oh, look, here's Trump and here's me and here's the line between us and here's the way he's affecting my faculty. That's the illegitimate move to a causal explanation.
And this is what I think is genius about this reading. What I found most insightful here is this apparent connection between this and the is-ought distinction in morality. It's not enough to say this is good to point out a fact like this brings me pleasure. We're playing a fundamentally different language game if we're doing the justificatory thing versus the stating facts thing. You know, they're related, that if you're making a case that this is good, well, the fact that it brings me pleasure might be one of the things that I cite, but it can't be the only thing, right? The is-ought distinction, that basic logical thing, means I have to bring in sort of another fundamental normative thing here. And so I think it's supposed to work the same way with identifications. Yes, it is one of the factors that justifies my saying the cat is on the mat, that I'm in the room with it and I have normal eyesight, but that's not the only thing. We also have to have the rules. We have to say, oh, well, whenever I'm in this sort of circumstances where I'm in normal lighting conditions and my eyes are working and nobody is giving me any reason to think that this is an abnormal circumstance, then I am warranted in accepting this. But that claim that I am warranted is not actually given by the causal account. That's just something that's part of the rules of the language game.
Yeah, and I think that's right, Mark. And in fact, you know, that whole long set of qualifications for that justification is not the way anybody would think about it at all. It in fact goes the other way, is that there are habits and internal and sometimes more explicit or less explicit rules for making those judgments. And then it's typically when you have other reasons that happened for questioning those judgments that you end up refining it. You know, you say, well, I close my eyes and then open them up a half a second later for all these reasons that I would, you know, expect to see what was there before me. And then if that's not true, then you figure out some other reasons. And I want to call them causal reasons, not in the way that Wes was referring to them, but you want to find some cause for it. There's a reason why when I closed my eyes and I opened my eyes up again, then I saw a tree in front of me instead of my computer.
You're departing from Rorty at that point.
I don't know. I think that's pure pragmatism straight up and down. It's just the way that pragmatic thinking about the world works.
Well, I like Dylan's point about the direction of justification. So thinking about not just a cat is on the mat, but there is a dangerous thing in front of me. Like, clearly we don't, in figuring that out, kind of evaluate objectively shapes and colors and then consult a set of rules. Like, no, we act more on these habits, these social customs, what has worked in the past evolutionarily for our species, not just for me. And then if I find something, well, okay, the thing didn't jump out at me, or somebody assures me, oh, no, it's not dangerous, then I might think more explicitly like, well, home, why do I still think that's dangerous, even though the person is telling me it's not? And I have to get into what actually my reasoning is. The reasoning is not causing the fear or not. It's other stuff that's causing the fear, and the reasoning that comes in involved when you're tempering it, when you're deepening, making it more subtle, the reaction.
So here's my problem with all of this, is that when a Locke or a Kant asks these, or a Descartes asks these sorts of questions, they're not actually trying to justify a specific knowledge claim. They're never asking, well, how do I know the cat is on the mat, or this or that? And then instead of giving the correct explanation that any normal person with common sense can give, they launch into a philosophical explanation, you know, as if someone asks them, hey, is it raining outside? Yes. How do you know? And then them launching into their epistemological theory. No one does that. But that doesn't mean that there isn't something interesting about saying how all of that works. In other words, you can abandon the idea that these sorts of theories undergird any sort of justification without abandoning the idea, well, you know, actually, I want a theory of knowledge. I want a theory of how all this works. In the same way that, for instance, if you're a mechanic and you're working on a car and someone else is trying to describe the activity of the mechanic and you say, well, the mechanic is never going to appeal to theory of combustion if he's fixing a combustion engine. He's going to appeal to sort of pragmatic considerations about, well, if you do X, then Y, you know, if the car functions this way and I have to do, you know, there's no reason to appeal to any deep scientific theory, but there is another standpoint, there is another framework from which you would be curious about those things. And you would be curious as to why doing X, Y, and Z on the engine actually fixes it. And you would need to delve into theory of combustion to understand that. And I'm not sure if this is a straw man or not, because I have to think more about whether or not Locke, for instance, is really confusing justification and causal explanation. But even if we reject that, and I think Rorty is right about this, if we reject that conflation, that doesn't mean we can't be interested in explaining how it is that people know things. Not the why from the internal logical space question, but the how. Take the external position and ask how. How is that possible?
Yeah. I would think that there's a lot of talking about how that is possible that can happen. And I guess I don't see how Rorty is objecting to it. And maybe the point is to try to be really clear about where the mistake is happening from Rorty's perspective and what's the problem with that mistake. I mean, part of it is that it just goes down a rabbit hole and you end up having this activity in philosophy that is constantly wringing its hands about where the foundation is and wringing its hands about stuff that just doesn't matter. Distinctions that don't make a difference.
Well, it doesn't matter to who. As long as someone is curious about it, it matters. It matters to that person who's curious about it.
So can I read a quote here from Rorty? I think what Wes was saying about the philosopher just wants knowledge of how this works. Rorty is all for that. It's just he thinks that it's going to be scientific knowledge, that this idea of an a priori philosophical way of investigating this is going to be bunk. And the quote that gets at that, page 152, if Kant had gone straight from the insight that the singular proposition is not to be identified with the singularity of a presentation to sense, in other words, if he didn't mix up knowing how and knowing that, to a view of knowledge as a relationship between persons and propositions, he would not have needed the notion of synthesis. He might have viewed a person as a black box emitting sentences, the justification for these emissions being found in his relationship to his environment, including the emissions of his fellow black boxes. The question, how is knowledge possible, would then have resembled the question, how are telephones possible? Meaning something like, how can one build something which does that? Physiological psychology rather than epistemology would then have seemed to be the only legitimate follow-up to Aristotle and Locke.
Right, which suggests to me, to satisfy Rorty, we have to become behaviorists, not just in the limited Sellers sense of epistemological behaviorists, but we have to become full-blown behaviorists and ultimately, I think, relativists. It just simply doesn't seem plausible to me that we can explain these things simply behavioristically. We have to appeal to internal states to talk about these things. If we really want to shed light on the problem, I mean, we can abandon the problem. That's another option.
I think we should take up that challenge in part two, which is going to be for us in a few minutes. For you folks, if you're not Partially Examined Life citizens, it's going to be next week. So you don't want to wait for that. You want to go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, sign up to be a citizen, and get the ad-free, unbroken citizen version right now. See ya there, or next week.